Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Welcome to the second day of our Bhagavad Gita seminar, the essence of Bhagavad Gita. So yesterday we gave an introduction, really. First of all, at least an introduction. Why the middle six chapters of Bhagavad Gita, what's so important about them, and how the discussion in Bhagavad Gita leads into them, that these middle six chapters are describing devotional service, which is what Bhagavad Gita is all about. This is the message of Bhagavad Gita, that we should all render devotional service. And we saw how in the first verse of the seventh chapter, Krishna explained very, very briefly the basic elements which make up devotional service. And the first thing was, what was the first thing? Can you remind me? What's the first thing you have to do in order to be Krishna conscious? You've got to have faith. Well, in a certain sense, but in terms of what we said yesterday, yes. Exactly. Yes. Maya Sakta Mana. Mana means the mind, and that's how Krishna began that verse. Maya Sakta Mana Parta. Chapter 7, verse 1. First of all, you have to fix your mind on Krishna, if you're going to be Krishna conscious. Then of course you've got to render service to Krishna, that has to be there. But without having your mind fixed on Krishna nicely, then your whatever activities you're doing, well, in material life they do so many activities, like working in this way and that, and singing even, and talking, and cooking and cleaning and so on and so forth. All these different things we can do in service to Krishna, they do in material life. So what is the difference then? Well, the first difference is the devotees are thinking of Krishna and their minds are fixed on Krishna in that mood of devotion, in that mood of service. So we went on then. We got up to, it was about, I think, verse 12 or so, and Krishna, having initially made this point that we need to fix our minds on him, then Krishna gave us some ideas how we could fix our minds on him. Like, I am the taste of water, for example. I am the light of the sun and moon. So many things that we come across every day in our lives. How we can understand, how we should understand that they are connected with Krishna. And then, whatever we see, wherever we look, we'll see something which will remind us of Krishna. Because we'll know, this is Krishna's. This is Krishna's potency. This belongs to Krishna. So in this way, everything, we can connect with Krishna. And our minds will be connected with Krishna. You know, Prabhupada gives an example that if you know something belongs to someone that you love, then when you see that, it reminds you of the person and brings out your loving feeling. So, like for example, your child. Prabhupada gives the example of the child's shoe. The child has gone to school or gone away somewhere, and the mother is missing the child, then the mother sees a shoe belonging to the child, doubtless lying around in the middle of the house somewhere, just abandoned. But the mother sees the shoe of the child, and then she remembers, oh, my child, this is my child's shoe. Because of the connection with the child, then it brings out the motherly emotions. Not that she has some specific fascination with shoes as such, but it's the child. So similarly, even the taste of water, something as ordinary and everyday as the taste of water, when the devotee drinks some water, then the devotee remembers, ah, the taste of this water is Krishna, or Krishna's potency. Krishna is behind this. This belongs to Krishna. And in this way, the devotee feels some appreciation, and the attachment for Krishna rises within the heart. So like this, this is Krishna consciousness, which literally, of course, means being conscious of Krishna. If you're going to be Krishna in Krishna consciousness, you have to be conscious of Krishna. Means you have to be thinking about Krishna, otherwise you're not in Krishna consciousness, are you? Yeah. You may be doing something for Krishna, but if you're not doing it in that consciousness that you're doing it for Krishna, and how it's important in that way, and how to do it nicely for Krishna, then even though the activity is being done for Krishna, but it would make it a lot richer and a lot deeper if your mind was also really involved in the process and you're really aware of what was going on in that sense. So therefore, Krishna then, at the beginning of this whole section, these whole middle six chapters of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna makes this point very vividly and in different ways, how we really, we have to fix our minds on him, our minds have to be attached to him, and then some ideas how to do like that. So that brought us up to verse 12, in which Krishna, if you recall, he made the point that all these things are his energy, not necessarily himself in person, but his energy. But at the same time, you cannot separate his energy from him. So therefore, you know, he is saying, I am this, I am that. In that sense, it's a little indirect. What do we call that sense of that the energy is one with, is Krishna, but at the same time there's a sense of separateness also? What do we call that? Achintya bhed abhed tattva. Yeah. Bhed means different from, and abhed means not different from. That these things, just like here we are, we're standing in the light. You know, this room has no windows, so if we closed all the doors and turned off the lights, we would be in complete darkness. But now we have the lights on and we can see. So the light is everywhere, but the lights are in the ceiling. I think you should just turn this down slightly. The lights are in the ceiling, but their energy, the effulgence of light coming from them, is all over. And you cannot separate this light from the actual light fittings. Yeah. I mean, if you took out the light fittings, the light would be gone. So they're just very, very much part of the light, but at the same time, the light is there, and the light fitting is there, and the energy, the light is spread all around. So there's this oneness and difference. Right now, so first thing is you have to think of Krishna. Different ways to think of Krishna. But as we mentioned yesterday, It is not a matter of just being an armchair philosopher, that we just sit around and think about Krishna and we think, oh, Krishna is so nice and Krishna consciousness is so nice that I think I'll just sit here more and think about it more. No, there's this other element also. You think, but then you have to act. You have to render devotional service. And in fact, a natural consequence of thinking about Krishna will be that the inspiration to serve him will rise naturally as just part of that, a natural product of the process of thinking about him. Yeah, that basically the idea is that Krishna is so wonderful. Krishna is so great. Krishna is so merciful. Krishna is so kind. Krishna is so wonderful in so many ways that I should serve him. Yeah, it just follows that I should do something. The devotee becomes inspired. Krishna is so wonderful that the devotee feels that I must render some service. Yeah. So then these two parts are there. And coming into the next little section, if you look in your little overview notes, it's section C there. The three modes are controlled by Krishna, therefore surrender. So in other words, to make everything complete and to really bring everything to the point where it should come to, you have to surrender. This is what Krishna says here in verse 13 or verse 14, I think, actually. Well, anyway, verse 13. So this section is 13 and 14. If you happen to have a Bhagavad Gita with you today, I hope you do. You've still got some? If anyone needs one, then at the end of the session, just see Chaitanya Prabhu, they're available. So in verse 13, well, actually, interesting little point is that one of our acharyas, Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary on Bhagavad Gita, Hare Krishna, at the end of his purport to verse 12, verse 12 is that verse where Krishna says that it is me and it isn't me, that one indifferent principle. Then, according to Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary on that verse, he presents his commentary quite a lot in the form of extra conversation between Krishna and Arjuna. And according to him, at that point, at the end of verse 12, and before Krishna gets into verse 13, Arjuna says, well, look, you know, if you are the taste of water and the light of the sun and moon and all these things, why don't people become devotees more? You know, if it's really so much like that, and you're just everywhere and everything, then what's wrong with the people? What happened to them? So then Krishna speaks verse 13. What's the problem? They're deluded by the modes. Goodness, passion and ignorance. And they don't know Krishna, who's above the modes. They're under the modes, like we are under the roof here in a sense. I mean, we are under the roof. But the idea in a sense is Krishna is above, and because we are, in this case, we are under the roof, we can't see what is above the roof. Therefore, we're not really doing anything about what may be above the roof. So Krishna is above us. He's in another realm. And in our conditioned state, when we are deluded by these modes, then we don't have access. So it's like, well, you know, we just carry on in terms of what we are experiencing directly, and not in terms of what is going on above. So like this, people are just carrying on in material life. And even though Krishna is there and Krishna is so wonderful and great, but they're What do they say? Where ignorance is bliss, it's folly to be wise. Yeah. We are happy in material life, eating, sleeping, mating and defending, and working in the factory and all sorts of nice things like that. And we don't need anything else. Anyway, now back to this point about, you know, like the next step. First you fix your mind on Krishna, you have to do that. Otherwise, how can you be Krishna conscious? So then Krishna speaks verse 14. The next step is, you've got to surrender. Not just sit there and think about Krishna, but you've got to do something about it. This divine energy of mind consisting of the three modes of material nature is difficult to overcome, but those who have surrendered unto me can easily cross beyond it. So, being inspired through thinking of Krishna, how great Krishna is, how wonderful Krishna is, the devotee feels inspired. I want to surrender to him. So when the devotee surrenders and takes shelter of Krishna and dedicates his or her activities to Krishna while thinking of Krishna, Krishna takes charge. Krishna takes charge of the devotee and gives protection and guidance and makes all arrangements for the devotee. And in this way, the devotee joins Krishna up there in that area above the modes of material nature. So surrender has to be there. We have to give up our independence, and you know, even sitting around thinking of Krishna and just doing that. And Krishna says, you know, if you're thinking about Krishna, you have to think about what Krishna says. Krishna says, surrender to me, serve me. If you're sitting there and then you think, yes, that sounds very nice. What else does Krishna say? Oh, Krishna says you should eat prasadam. Oh yes, I must do that. Yeah, so if we're just sitting there thinking of Krishna only, then we're still maintaining a position of independence. But Krishna wants us to surrender and serve him and dedicate our activities and everything, our whole lives, for his pleasure. This makes the whole thing complete. Not just a mental process, but everything. Mind, body, words, assets, whatever you have at your disposal, use it in Krishna's service. And in this way, this is surrender. This is surrender. Just like in a battle, if you're on the losing side and then you surrender and the army come over and say, okay, give it your surrender, give us your money, and you say, no, I need bus fare back home. Then you haven't really surrendered, have you? But they say, okay, dig a hole. Then you say, well, look, you know, I'm not that type. So, surrender means that Krishna says, you do this, you say yes, and you do it. Right. So then, the next section is D, the impious lack knowledge and never surrender to Krishna, and the pious develop knowledge and surrender. You know, the basic idea here is, based on 14, verse 14, Krishna's made this point about surrendering and serving and giving your life and so on, and then how he reciprocates. So now what Krishna's going to talk about is, who can surrender and who can't surrender? And you know, we, hopefully being devotees or aspiring devotees or wanting to become devotees, we should then try and figure out, how can I become one of these people who will be able to surrender? And if I have any qualities, which are the qualities which inhibit surrender, the qualities that these people who can't and don't surrender have, then I should get rid of them. So first of all then, in 15, this is a very interesting section. In 15, Krishna talks about four types of people who cannot surrender. They cannot surrender. The mudhas, the miscreants who are grossly foolish. Well, wait a minute, no. The duskritana, they're the first ones. Well, first of all, in terms of the verses, the order is slightly different, but first of all, the foolish people, then the lowest amongst mankind, then those whose knowledge is stolen by illusion, then those who have the atheistic nature of demons. The mudhas, the naradamas, the mayaya parita jnanas, and the asuras, or those who have the asura bhava, the nature of the asuras. These four types of people don't and can't surrender to Krishna. So we should make sure we're not in any of those categories. You know, there's a lot that could be said about this, but we'll just very briefly mention that the first category, they're the mudhas. Mudha means, like, very foolish, or even Prabhupada would say, ass-like person. You know, dull, no aspirations in life, even materially, as long as they can get some food to eat and there's a roof over their heads and just very, very basic things like that, then that's enough for them. So this type of foolish person who, you know, their minds are very closed off and limited like that. Then the naradamas, they're a very interesting category. Prabhupada here translates the word naradama as the lowest amongst mankind. So you might think that people who are just really foolish and stupid and just not interested in anything, they might be the lowest amongst mankind. But actually, Prabhupada is presenting a different picture. The lowest amongst mankind are like the big material exploiters, the big businessmen, the big politicians. Don't tell anyone in the ANC we said that. But these types of people are the lowest amongst mankind. For their sense gratification, they don't care. They can kill people and just crush people and destroy nature and all that sort of thing just for their sense gratification. As long as they get some sense gratification, then whatever it took to achieve that is fine. Like an example we give of this is that I forget which company it was, but it was some big company I read quite a few years ago, that they had some production line like conveyor belts with things going, and then, you know, they do something to it, then they send it on another conveyor belt. And all these conveyor belts were interrelated in that if one of them broke down, then the others would not get their supply and everything would just, you know, everything would stop. And they would lose money, which was, you know, a real tragedy. So They produced a report. Even they had one problem. They had a serious problem in this regard, is that, you know, they had hundreds of people working on these things, and every now and then someone would die, actually. And when they die, then the whole system would stop. So they produced this report, which I saw, which was about how they could quickly get the system going again even when someone died. You know, how to get them out of the way as quickly as possible, get the new one in as quickly as possible, and get production going, and that's success. And the fact that he died, well, that's just like an obstacle. And you have to overcome your obstacles. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, these people, like these businessmen, these politicians, they don't really care often. I mean, maybe some of them do care. I'm sure some do care. But many of them, they don't really care very much. So they're the Naradhanas, the lowest amongst mankind. The big, heavy, nasty, aggressive materialists. So then there's another category, Mayaya Parita Jnana. Jnana means knowledge. So this means intellectual types. But their knowledge is Mayaya Aparita. It's stolen by illusion. Even though they have good brains and they can figure out many things, but it's all to do with the material world and nothing about getting free of the material world. So their knowledge is stolen by illusion. And, you know, this is typically people like the scientists and the writers and poets and artists and people like that, who with very flowery language, at least say the writers and people like that, poets, you know, very beautifully, they can describe a situation of utter rubbish as if it was just lovely. You know, what beautiful rubbish. So this is typical. Yeah, this is really typical. Things like the Big Bang Theory and stuff like that. So much brain power has gone into it. And so many words are spoken about it. But it equals specifically exactly zero. It's just that because they have big brains, they can express it in many ways and very cleverly. So it's like they have many zeros. I'm sure you've heard Prabhupada gave this example, that some man, he may say, I have 10 zeros. Another says, well, ha ha, I've got 20 zeros. But it's all zero. But they're in illusion. Maya has stolen their real understanding. They don't understand that we've just got a whole lot of zeros. We need at least a one. If not, you know, a two or a three, but at least a one. And then it'll become worth something. So this is the Maya Parita Jnanas, materialistic intellectuals. Like you may have heard, we've told the story many times before. I think it was Wittgenstein, but actually I can't remember exactly, one of the European philosophers, he developed the philosophy of the doubt, that whatever you hear or come across, you doubt it. Don't just accept things. You know, in other words, don't just be a sort of innocent fool who just accepts things just because people say it. You know, like someone murders someone, they sentence him to death. And then at the end he says, oh, I'm sorry. And then you say, oh, look, he said he's sorry. Should let him off. Like Al Capone, I don't know if you ever heard of Al Capone. A really very brutal man. At the end, when they were locking him up, finally they caught him for tax evasion. He said, actually, I never meant to hurt anyone. Right. But Wittgenstein, he came up with this philosophy of the doubt. You must doubt everything. There has to be intellectual integrity. Don't just accept things with your eyes closed. You've got to go into it and see. So it sounds, in certain respects, of course, it is good. But then in the end, well, he developed quite a following and even now, a couple of hundred years later, he's still studied in the universities a lot, all over the world. And he got a following. People were into doubting. And they thought they were doing very well, and they held him in great esteem. But after some time he said, you know, all these people who are following me, they're all fools. He said, because I doubt my own philosophy. So this is really my Parityagyana. Talk about wasting time, you know. And then there's the asuras, or those people who have the asura bhava. Bhava in this sense means nature, a demoniac type of nature. And most particularly, well, asura literally means, sura means god or godly, and asura means ungodly or anti-god, like that. So it's particularly those people who reject God, reject Krishna or just God, and they say there's no God like this. This is the asura bhava, the nature of demons. Of course, you've got different levels of that, from people who are like, you know, really heavy atheists, to people who are just like agnostic, kind of borderline, but on the atheistic side. Right, so these four then, they have great difficulties surrendering to Krishna. The mudhas, they think, why should we surrender to Krishna? You know, what's the point? We're going to have to do something. We're happy doing as little as possible, and as long as we eat, we're eating. We've got a roof over our heads, that's all we need. So why should we bother surrendering to Krishna? The Naradanas think, Krishna, who needs Krishna? I'm in control around here. And the Maya Parityagyanas, they think they have a better idea, they have it figured out better. And the Asuras think there is no Krishna, so what is the question of it surrendering to someone who doesn't exist? Right, so they cannot surrender to Krishna. And then in verse 16, Krishna talks about, well, he begins a discussion which goes on to verse 19, discussing about four types of people who can or do surrender, or who try to surrender. What does Krishna say? How does Prabhupada translate it? Four kinds of pious men begin to render devotional service unto me. The distressed, the desirer of wealth, the inquisitive, and he who's searching for knowledge of the Absolute. So, Krishna says they begin to render devotional service. In other words, Krishna doesn't say that these people surrender. It's like they begin, or they try. This is the sense. They're like candidates. They're like candidates, more than the people who are really qualified. But at least they're candidates. They can surrender. They try. They begin. This is the sense. So these are the four types of people who are, you know, they could become devotees if all goes well. The distressed, the desire of wealth, the inquisitive, curious, and those who are really, really trying to understand the Absolute. So what categories are we in? Or category are we in? Why did we come to Krishna consciousness? You know, maybe some of you came to the seminar, for example, because someone you know said that there's this Bhagavad Gita seminar, and you just thought, oh, you know, you're not a devotee, you're not really involved. But then you thought, oh, really, Bhagavad Gita, I see, okay. Let me go and see. So that means you're kind of in the curious category. And others may take to Krishna consciousness because they're suffering, they're distressed, and, you know, they just want help, something like that. So there are these four categories. And they may take to Krishna consciousness, but some are more likely than others. The distressed and the desire of wealth, they're kind of related to each other, in that their interest in Krishna, the basis upon which they're having a look at Krishna consciousness, taking an interest, is very material. So one is in distress and he's thinking, oh, Krishna help, God help me, I can't handle it. Another, you know, wants material things, you know, as they say in Hinduism, give me a house and a car and a colour TV, Om Jai Jagadish Hare. That, you know, this is an easy way to get things. Very good. You know, as one man actually told me a while ago, he said, I have taken a vow, a solemn vow, that I will offer a quarter of a liter of milk, a few bananas, and like a couple of flowers or something like that, and a piece of dhoti. Hare Krishna. For 1 month, every day, I will offer these things. And at the end of the month, I am praying to Krishna, please give me a new BMW. So this is called desiring wealth, desiring some material facility. And, you know, it's a good deal, isn't it? Quarter of a liter of milk, a few bananas and sweets, and get a BMW. Hey, that sounds good. So we can see these two, it's purely materialistic actually. And, you know, the person who's distressed, if somehow by Krishna's grace or whatever, the distress goes, then he doesn't need Krishna any longer. Does it? Because Krishna's there simply to help with the distress, and other than that, he's irrelevant. Or the person who's desiring material things, once they get those things, well, why do we need Krishna? So it's like, you know, the principle is something like, when your car is out running out of petrol, you go into the petrol station and fill it up with petrol. But then when you've got plenty of petrol, you don't go into the petrol station, do you? Why bother? Just to look at the petrol pumps. Something like that. So, you know, this thing is very much, you know, need-oriented, desire-oriented. What, where the person is at is a very important thing. If where they're at is they simply want relief from their distress, then when they've got the relief, they don't need Krishna. So therefore, again, the idea is they may become devotees, but they may not. They may not. Because when their distress is over or they've got what they want, then they say, you know, bye-bye Krishna. And when we are in distress again, we'll give you another call. So it's like that. So their position is not really very good, not so good. It's certainly better than just being one of these four types of materialists we talked about, but it's not very strong in terms of being fixed in Krishna consciousness. Then the curious people, their interest is not materialistic. It's more like intellectual, it's more like a mental or some sort of interest involving the intelligence. What is this about? Let me go and check it out. This sort of idea. So it is on a higher level than just in terms of gross material needs. But, you know, having checked out Krishna consciousness on the basis of your curiosity, when you found out, yes, it's like this and that and so on, then you might think, okay, what's next? Well, let me go and check out the Buddhists. You see? So this curiosity, it's a higher level of interest than just distress or desiring wealth. But it's also not such a strong basis for really becoming Krishna conscious in a real and lasting way. But now the fourth category of person who is really searching for knowledge, he really wants to understand life and God and get to know these things and come to grips with these things and get into these things. This is a much stronger basis, isn't it? For actually developing a real connection with Krishna consciousness and getting into Krishna consciousness. So therefore Krishna says, let's see, in verse 17, the one who is in full knowledge, this fourth one, and is always engaged in pure devotional service is the best. Verse 18, they are all undoubtedly great souls, because at least they approach him. So that's very good, as opposed to just being distracted by the material world in some way. So they're all great. But he who is situated in knowledge of me, I consider to be just like my own self. Yeah. So, therefore, as we're trying to develop our Krishna consciousness, we should know clearly that it's very important to develop knowledge about Krishna and how Krishna works and how Krishna consciousness works. If you don't, if you remain on the sentimental platform, you know, I like Krishna when he smiles at me, but when he frowns at me, then well, I don't know. Or when Krishna is giving me things, oh, I like him very much. But when he's taking things away, well, you know, maybe I'll look elsewhere. Maybe I should have become a Christian after all. Should have stuck with the NGK. But someone who's situated, a devotee who's situated in knowledge, then when Krishna perhaps is giving some material things, that devotee will understand this is Krishna's mercy and I must use these things in his service. And if things are materially not going so well, then the devotee understands Krishna's testing me. If the devotee is more in knowledge, Krishna's testing me. Krishna is showing me that this material world is unreliable. I shouldn't depend on it. I should depend on him. So like this, being in knowledge then will help the devotee to come through in advance. Whereas like the one who's approaching Krishna on the basis of distress, please save me, help me. But if things then get worse before they get better, then the person thinks, well, what's the point of praying to Krishna? He doesn't do his job. I'm gonna look elsewhere. Just like we saw a newspaper, thing board with the top stories yesterday, and it said, this was from the Mail and Guardian or something like that. It said, tsunami. Where was God? In other words, he wasn't doing it. He was sleeping on the job. This God guy. We'll jump in and do our relief and we'll be better than God. Okay, so like this is the point here, and it's a very important point. And then Krishna sums up, verse 19 is the end of this section. After many births and deaths, he who is actually in knowledge, gotta catch this one, he surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very rare. Right. So that's that section. Now, section E. Hare Krishna. Section E. Others who have no knowledge. those who surrender to demigods and those who are impersonalists. So well, you know, it's not exactly that these are two more categories of those who don't surrender. But they are subcategories of those who don't surrender. The demigod worshippers, what category would you put them in? Of the four who don't surrender? Huh? Didn't catch that. Foolish. Could be, yeah. Could be foolish. Could be Maya Paritagyana, like that, in knowledge is stolen by illusion. Rather than surrender to Krishna, they surrender to a demigod. So these are like subsets. And then the impersonalists, what category are they in? They're either asuras or Maya Paritagyana. Because some impersonalists are not really anti the personal God, but some, like the Mayavadis, are anti-God. So they're actually asuras. Others may be more in the Maya Paritagyana categories. But now these two categories are very prominent. So Krishna gives them some direct attention. From 20 to 23, it's about the demigod worshippers. That people whose intelligence is stolen by material desires surrender unto demigods, you know, particular demigods in terms of their particular aspirations. If they want money, they worship Lakshmi. If they want rain, like in the Govardhan Leela, the inhabitants of Vrindavan, they wanted rain, they worshipped Indra. We just had Katyayani Vrata. It finished, it was like a couple of weeks ago. So the worship of Katyayani is for the young girls who want good husbands. So you don't generally catch the boys worshipping Katyayani. I mean, you know. But if a boy wants a good wife, you know who he worships? Lord Shiva. Yeah. So this is what Krishna, the principle is what Krishna is talking about here in verse 20. They follow the particular rules and regulations according to their natures or according to what they're looking for. And different people are looking for different things, and different demigods give different things, but not other things. So it works like that. And then Krishna goes on to say in verses 21 and 22, he helps them. Actually, he helps everyone fulfill whatever their desire is. So if they want to worship a demigod and get, you know, whatever that demigod has to offer, Krishna helps them. It's not that Krishna gets in the way and says, look, you know, you're doing the wrong thing, you should worship me, and then he interferes with their demigod worship. No, he helps them. Even, for that matter, I think it's in the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam, there's one purport. Prabhupada says that if a person is an atheist, like a philosophically minded atheist, and they want to argue God out of existence, Prabhupada says Krishna will give them the intelligence to come up with a brilliant atheistic philosophy so that they feel, right, I proved it. There is no God. Wow, that was great. But Krishna gave them the intelligence. So in the same way, people want material things from the demigods. Krishna gives them the faith and helps them. That's 21 and 22. But 23, you know, you poor little demigod worshipper, Men of small intelligence worship the demigods. Hare Krishna. Which is a nice way of saying stupid people. Alpa medasa, alpa. Alpa means very small. You know, it's not used so much in Hindi. But in Bengali, they still use this word alpa. So when they're taking prasadam, if you go to our temple in Mayapur, you'll hear the Bengali devotee saying, alpa, alpa. Means they just want a little, don't give me too much. Like that. Yeah. So they just have little intelligence. Not much at all. Sure. So men of small intelligence worship the demigods, and their fruits are limited and temporary. Those who worship the demigods go to the planets of the demigods, but my devotees ultimately reach my supreme planet. Then verses 24 and 25, Krishna talks about the impersonalists. Avyaktam vyaktam apanam manyante mam abhudaya. I don't know how your Sanskrit is. But about the demigods, demigod worshippers, Krishna said, those people are alpa medasa. Medasa means intelligence. Little. And buddhi. Buddhi also means intelligence. What does Krishna say here? The impersonalists are abhudaya. They have no intelligence. So they're even worse. Abhudaya means no intelligence. Yeah. Unintelligent men who don't know me perfectly think that I, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, was impersonal before and have now assumed a personality. Due to their small knowledge, they don't know my higher nature. So, you know, like you see these pictures sometimes of Krishna. There's Krishna standing there. And behind Krishna is the Om sign. You've seen pictures like that? You get them sometimes. So the idea is, Krishna has come from the Om. Yeah. In other words, Krishna was impersonal. The impersonal manifested as Krishna. But actually it's not accurate. And Krishna, later he says that this impersonal Brahman has come from me. Then in general, verse 25 is kind of more in general. These people, whether they're demigod worshippers, impersonalists, or materialistic intellectuals, or just foolish, whatever it may be, Krishna says, I'm never manifest to the foolish and unintelligent. For them I am covered by my internal potency. Therefore they don't know me. In other words, Krishna reserves the right to not be accessible to those who he's not confident in, that they're going to be able to, you know, handle the relationship. Yeah. He and you can't force him. You know, you can't force him at gunpoint. You can't bribe him. You can't talk him into it. Or, you know, through someone, or maybe through someone you know if it's a devotee, but not really. You know, he remains out of people's control unless he wants to be in their control or connected with them. He reserves the right. Okay, let's see now. So, the last section, F, is kind of summarizing who can surrender. Well, that's sort of the main thrust, really. Krishna says, establishes his own position in 26. And then in 27 he describes how everyone in this world is in illusion. And then 28 and 29 and 30, Krishna's very much summarizing who can surrender, the qualifications for becoming a devotee and advancing in Krishna consciousness. If you acted piously in previous lives and in this life, and if your sinful actions are completely eradicated and you're freed from the dualities of delusion, then you can engage in devotional service nicely. Like this. Those in full consciousness of me, this is verse 30, who know me, the Supreme Lord, to be the governing principle of the material manifestation of the demigods and of all methods of sacrifice, can understand and know me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even at the time of death. Now, this last two verses, actually, I didn't read the second to last one. Krishna there says that intelligent people are endeavoring for liberation from old age and death, take refuge in me in devotional service. They're actually Brahman. So here in these two verses, Krishna, 29 and 30, Krishna is explaining, or not explaining really, but at least referring to certain types of understanding, being actually Brahman, being truly spiritual. And then in regards to himself in 30, how he is the governing principle of the material manifestation. He's governing the demigods. He is the Lord of all sacrifices. So people who understand these things, Krishna says, they can know me at the time of death. Now this is very important because as we go on to chapter 8, let's go on to chapter 8. What is chapter 8 titled? Attaining the Supreme. And when do you attain the Supreme? When might you attain the Supreme? Well, in a certain sense, like very classical sense, you might attain the Supreme when you die. Then you may go back to Godhead. Until you die, you're here in the material world. Of course, if you become fully Krishna conscious before you die, then effectively you're liberated. But to actually go to Goloka Vrindavan, generally the understanding is this may happen, it could happen when you die. So this chapter is titled Attaining the Supreme, or in other words, how to deal with death, how to prepare yourself with death, which is just what Krishna referred to at the end of the last verse, isn't it? In chapter 7. That, you know, these intelligent, if you come to the spiritual spiritual level, if you're one of these intelligent people engaged in devotional service, you can come to the level of Brahman. So that's one thing. Then you understand Krishna in this way and that, the Lord of sacrifice, governing principle of this material world. So, if you can understand all these things, Krishna said, then you can know me at the time of death. You'll be able to deal with the time of death and go back to Godhead. Right, so then in chapter 8, Arjuna begins the chapter by asking Krishna in verses 1 and 2, what are these things? You know, in verse 29, he probably didn't say, look, you know, in verse 29, you referred to Brahman. What is this Brahman in chapter 7? Now you've started chapter 8. So, but he just asks, what is Brahman? What is the self? What are fruit of activities? What is this material manifestation? What are the demigods? And then, who is the Lord of sacrifice? How does he live in the body? So these are all questions to do with verse 29 and verse 30. But the main point, the main question is, And how can we understand you? How can we know you at the time of death? In other words, how can we be fixed in consciousness of you at the time of death? So that's what this chapter is about. And in your overview notes, you'll see that we've put the first four verses together because the first two are the questions, and verses 3 and 4 are Krishna's answers to all of the questions except the one about how we can know you at the time of death. Yeah. So what does Krishna say then in 3 and 4? The indestructible transcendental living entity is Brahman. His eternal nature is called Adhyatma, the self. Action pertaining to the development of the material bodies of the living entities is karma. Because Arjuna asked, what is karma? And then the physical nature is the material manifestation. The universal form is the Adidaiva, or the demigods. And me, Krishna, I, the Supreme Lord, in the heart of every living entity, I am the Lord of sacrifice. So that's all the questions answered. That's all the questions answered, except the last question. How are we going to know you at the time of death? How are we going to be fixed on you at the time of death? So, at that time we go to you, and we don't take birth again in this world. So, now, for that one, the rest of the chapter is the answer. Yeah. The rest of the chapter is the answer. So we go on to section B, remembering Krishna. And first of all, in verse 5, there is a very brief answer to that last question. Now this is the answer actually, but it's very, very brief, and then Krishna is going to elaborate. Whoever at the end of his life quits his body remembering me alone, at once attains my nature, of this there's no doubt. So that's the answer. That's the answer. How can we know Krishna at the end of this life? We have to remember him. We just remember him, then we will attain to him. So then Krishna goes on to discuss this whole subject from different angles of vision. In verse 6, Krishna makes the general point how things work at the time of death. Whatever you remember, you go to that. Whatever it is. Prabhupada would laugh about the hippies. The hippies would talk about getting stoned. I don't know if any of you heard of that. And Prabhupada, they thought this is, you know, very cool. And Prabhupada said, yes, they're preparing to take birth as stones. You know, of course you might say, well, a stone is not a living being, it's not a species of life. But if people become too much contaminated and conditioned and too much in ignorance, they can be placed outside the 8,400,000 species of life. Yeah. Because the living entities, Krishna says in the second chapter, they're sarvagata. They're all pervading. They're everywhere. They're not just in the living bodies. They're everywhere. Because if they get too much out of it, then they fall out of the 8,400,000 species of life. Right, so whatever you think about when you die, you'll go to that. So, in other words, watch out what you're thinking about. Yeah. And then, let me just catch up here. Where am I? Oops, yeah. Mm. So now the question may arise, because Krishna said, remember me. And, you know, your future depends on what you remember. So again, the question appears to be arising, do we need to do anything, or do we just remember? So Krishna addresses this question in verse 7. This is a really important verse. Therefore, Arjuna, you should always think of me in the form of Krishna, and at the same time carry out your prescribed duty of fighting. With your activities dedicated to me, and your mind and intelligence fixed on me, you'll attain me without doubt. And then verse 8 finishes off this section. If you're thinking about Krishna, you're sure to reach Krishna. Okay, how are you doing, devotees? If you're asleep, put your hand up. Okay. So it seems to be 2:30. So I think we'll just take a little break, and then we'll come back refreshed. Or I think you're going to have a snack, isn't it? Or you'll come back really refreshed. And then, so we'll continue on at 3 o'clock. Srila Prabhupada ki.